Hello there, this is Reed O'Mara, one of the producers of the Multicultural Middle Ages. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode on Jewish animalities. We hope you enjoy the episode, but we wanted to give you a heads up that due to the nature of some of the recording this time around, there is a little bit of background noise at the beginning of the episode. We don't think it's too distracting, especially because the content is so amazing, but we just wanted to give you a heads up. Thanks for understanding, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. My name is Reed O'Mara. I am a PhD candidate at Case Western Reserve University, and I am also a co-producer of this podcast. Today, I'll actually be talking about something that is near and dear to my heart and related to my own research, which is Jewish art and culture from the Middle Ages. We've done a couple episodes in the past that are about articles or recent publications, and today we're doing something similar, but also a little bit different. Today we're going to be talking about a symposium that was held in the middle of May, 2024, at the Newberry Library and Northwestern University in Chicago and Evanston. And this conference is Cosmic Ecologies, Animalities in Pre-Modern Jewish Culture. Something also important that I should say here at the beginning is that I was not only in attendance at the conference, but I actually had the privilege to speak at it. And so I was luckily able to see all the other papers come together and also be a part of the Q&A. And today, I'm joined by the organizers of the conference, Alina Gertzman, Julie A. Harris, and David Shaivitz. I'll let them introduce themselves. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Alina, would you like to introduce yourself first?
This is Alina Gertzman. I'm a professor of medieval art at Case Western Reserve University, where I teach Jewish and Christian medieval art.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alina, who I should say is a returning guest to this podcast. So we're glad to have you back. David, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm David Shaivitz. I'm a professor of Jewish history at Northwestern. I also direct our Center for Jewish and Israel Studies. And I'm excited to be on the podcast for my first visit.
Thank you so much. We're glad to have you. Julie, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Julie Harris. I'm an independent scholar living on the North Shore of Chicago. And my field of interest is really medieval Iberia, but I've been working mostly on Jewish Iberia for the last 15 years or so. One of the reasons I got involved in this is because I became very interested in what animals, what their potential was for communication in medieval Iberia.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. And I actually think bringing in the fact that we're talking about animals today is a perfect segue into this symposium, Cosmic Ecologies. So I'll provide a description of the conference that was from the symposium's website, and then maybe we can talk about what this title means and what it entails. So, held in conjunction with the Medieval Academy of America's Centennial, this symposium addressed a plethora of topics: cosmic ecologies and their continuities across the animal, human, divine, demotic spectrum, visual and textual collisions between humanities and animalities, bestialization as a heuristic, animalization of Jews in Jewish and Christian discourses, zoocephali in material and literary sources, and monstrosities and hybridities as sites of wonder and liminality. So I think with that description in mind, we can just start off with what is meant by the phrase cosmic ecologies, and we can also talk about what was the inspiration for this symposium.
Well, I can start. I was actually starting to work on zoocephalic imagery in earnest, and Julie will remember that moment in 2021. She and I were having various animal-related conversations that fall. We were both often walking our dogs as we were having these conversations. I was on leave. No, pandemic was still raging. So, you know, animals in public gatherings, I think, were very much at least in my mind. And earlier that year, I was actually rereading David's first book, and he also seemed like a perfect person to approach for this conference. In terms of cosmic ecologies, at least in my mind, The idea of an ecology really takes its predicate from this concept of interdependence, right? Of various networks that weave together the different strata of the universe. And that generally, when we talk about cosmic ecologies, they shift away from what we understand as an anthropocentric worldview. But I think this shift, as we have seen in the symposium, ended up being anything but simple, or certainly anything but absolute. And that is precisely what we wanted to explore.
I would, you know, definitely echo Alina's interest in these questions of interconnections, of networks, of sometimes things that we think of as being binaries that turn out not to be human-animal or human-divine, angelic-demonic, all of these kinds of, you know, sort of neat pet generalizations that really break down the more you look into them. So that sort of framing of thinking about spectrums of spiritual meaning, spectrums of the ways in which they are understood in relationship to each other. And then also, and this was a topic that came up quite a bit in the conference, and it's one that I have written a little bit about and I'm very, very interested in, is also spectrums of source materials and spectrums of religious communities. So one of the things I think that is becoming more and more clear in the field of medieval studies, and certainly came out very powerfully in many of the papers, is the fact that doing sort of medieval history and calling it Jewish history or Christian history or Islamic history, you know, those sort of generalizations too break down, and we end up with these spectrums of interconnections instead.
Being at the conference was really exciting. There were so many conversations to be had about these binaries and spectrums and how they fall apart. And you've already touched on it a little bit, but I think a good question here would just be why animalities and medieval Jewish culture specifically is so rich a topic.
I think that it's particularly important and particularly fabulous in this case, because medieval Jewish culture really does present the human-animal balance in this constant state of oscillation, right? As David mentioned, sometimes it's a binary and sometimes it's a spectrum. And we have hybridity that is morphing into multiplicity. You know, what are the differences between the two? We have animality that reflects and refracts and transmutes into humanity. And what we heard, I think, in the symposium from some radically new ideas to me, the familial partnerships of beasts to the striking ensoulment of objects, from zoocephalic humans to animals that were present at liturgical celebrations, it was clear that medieval Jewish universe really does offer us a myriad of pleasantly unstable ways in which human exceptionalism is compromised, and where these radical distinctions between human and non-human animals are completely turned on its head.
So I love that phrase, pleasantly unstable, which I think is a really nice way of describing sort of the vertigo that I think I felt at times in studying this material, in being at the conference, and that I hope came across to others as well. The only tiny asterisk I would add to that phrase is one of the things that came out in some of the papers too was sometimes the unpleasantly unstable nature of the way these questions get discussed, right? Which itself is sort of a fascinating way of thinking about the social and political, you know, contextualization of the way these debates happen, and sometimes the impact that ideas about animality or bestialization can have. So everything Alina said really resonates for me as well in terms of why this is an important topic to be tackled. In the book I published a few years ago and a book that I'm trying to wrap up right now, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about these questions of the natural world, theology, science, humans, animals, and getting a bunch of smart people in the room together to talk about a topic that I want to learn more about from all kinds of different vantage points was just hugely enriching. And I think speaks to the fact that sometimes the community of people, each coming with their own skill sets and from their own sort of particular vantage point, just can accomplish much, much more together than any one of them can in isolation.
Yeah, I would echo. I came in with a much more narrow focus, I suppose. But at the same time, I found the conference very useful and stimulating because I often feel a frustration working as an art historian in medieval Jewish manuscripts or any medieval manuscript by our inability sometimes to ask bigger questions of the material. And there's certain things I sort of can't work on or don't work on because it's too far away, or it doesn't connect, or it's a big idea that the text scholars can work on, or the theology scholars can work on, or the historians work on. But this conference allowed us to use animals as a conduit to do that kind of, or at least access that kind of plumbing of the big topics and hashing out some rabbinics and things that are fun and I don't often get to do as much as I'd like to. What are these big, how do these big ideas that we hear people talking about or presenting, big questions of what's an animal, what's a human, what's the line between them, what does Judaism say about it, what does medieval Judaism say about it? So if we have visual traditions of how a particular animal is used, how can we integrate what I'm also now learning, how can we integrate what we've just seen, this new research and on the big thoughts? And does it run against artistic tradition, art historical tradition, or can we work the two together? Can one inform the other? And that to me is very fascinating. I thought that the conference was very successful.
And I think one of the most important ways that these thoughts and those questions were opened up was actually not during the papers themselves, but during Q&A sessions. And also when you talk to people right after their papers.
Yes.
You know, again, like David and Julie, I was feeling a bit selfish because I am working on this material. And we gathered all these people I always wanted to meet and talk to. And here, not only do I get to hear them talk about the most fascinating of things, but also I get to grill them afterwards and have them answer millions of my questions. It was great fun.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible for me as well, just being new to this field and having this moment to interact with all of these people whose scholarship I've read. I think that we've talked a little bit now about how wonderful it was to bring all these people together for this symposium. And so I'm wondering if you would speak a little bit about the specific kinds of scholars who were invited to participate. For example, we've touched on that they come from a lot of different academic backgrounds. So we could address that. And we could also discuss the choice of session respondents, because I know that that was also very intentionally deliberated.
Well, I think we wanted a mix of scholars and a mix of approaches. And again, our choices were very much dictated by our own interests that luckily were shared. You know, I was particularly interested in inviting Beth Berkowitz and Rafe Nies, both of whom work on classical rabbinic literature and whose work I intensely respect. They also possess real breadth, something I also admire really in Ilya Rodov's scholarship, for example. But again, I'm an art historian, so I was also keenly interested in granular case studies, which is where your own paper, Reed, and Abby Kornfeld's paper really for me modeled this approach. But I think broadly speaking, we wanted to hear from specialists of art and theology, from those whose expertise lies in Ashkenazic as well as Sephardic material, from those who study sources in Hebrew and those who study sources in Yiddish. And in terms of respondents, I think the point here in bringing specialists in Christian and Islamic art to respond was supremely important. We looked at those who worked in animality, which was broadly conceived from a variety of different perspectives. And I think it was a felicitous idea because respondents were able to engage with the papers in a way that was fresh and, for me, often unexpected, in a way that was both synthetic and, again, really granular, really specific.
Yeah, on that question of respondents, so one of the really nice things that many of the respondents prefaced their own comments with was they would say something along the lines of, you know, I'm a little nervous speaking on this topic because it's not really something I know anything about, but, and then they'd go on to give a really insightful response. And I feel like that kind of positioning is exactly the right one, and it's one that we don't get enough of often in the academy, is you know, people have pored over some of these sources and definitely some of these images from so many perspectives for so many years. And then what happens when you parachute in somebody who has, you know, this deep, deep knowledge, but in something totally different or something related, but not directly overlapping? What does it look like from their vantage point? And some of the comments that came out of those responses and the way that generated conversation was really, really fruitful and generative. Alina noted the breadth of some of the people's scholarship, and that's so, so vital, right? To have somebody who has this wide-ranging knowledge, let's say in rabbinic literature or other kinds of sources. And a really great complement to that is depth, because so many of these subject matters, I'm thinking of medieval and early modern Kabbalah in particular, although it really is true for a lot of the material, the barrier to entry for studying this material is so, so high, right? To go back to something I said before, it kind of takes a scholarly village or a scholarly ecosystem in order to put all these different pieces together in a way that really no one individual would be able to do on their own.
Well, for me, said.
The best example of that was Margaret Graves's response from the Islamic world. And she really thought long and hard about her material and how to frame what she works on by using animals, or how animals work in her field, what animals are used for. And her response was so surprising and so indicative of her knowledge, but also her analytical skills. And for me, it was fantastic because, of course, being someone who works in Jewish Spain, my sources are not just Christian sources. Really, most of them actually are from the Islamic world. So to hear someone who's so skilled in that field asking the same questions, even in a 5 or 10 minute response, it was absolutely revelatory and fantastic.
And I would hope that it also enriched their own work, right? And also the way that it makes you rethink this fraught concept of influence, not just saying, oh, this is where you get your stuff from, but rather, oh, this is where our stuff is coming from. And that was very refreshing.
Yes, very refreshing. I think we're pointing to that this is a really special occurrence, that you had all of these people come together all around the same topic of animality. And I'm curious if you think that this signals any kinds of changes that are taking place within medieval studies, Jewish studies, literature, art history at the moment.
Well, I don't want to get on my soapbox, but I...
Please do.
Okay, well, I mean, we can answer this in a proper, somewhat anodyne way of saying, well, it opens up new avenues for research. It does. And it does, I think, confirm both the richness of medieval Jewish culture and also its place in the broader study of the Middle Ages. I think more significantly, it does signal a change. It rips us out of the confines of the notion of influence that all but squashes original contributions of, you know, when we're thinking about the majority and minority culture, as it were, right, that subsumes that other culture, that the minority culture, on this broad umbrella of response or assimilation or reaction. In mainstream scholarship, at least in art history, Jewish images are so often mischaracterized as, well, hybrid, since we're talking about animalities, right, as composite beasts that are, you know, a little bit Christian and a little bit Islamic and a little bit themselves, and they're familiar and foreign at once, but homogeneous somehow in their meaning. So I think for an art historian such as myself, who has been writing for years largely on Christian art, to see medieval Jewish art regularly marginalized is absolutely confounding. You know, first we focused on Christian European art, and Jewish images were seen as unusual but derivative. Then the global approach comes, and all of a sudden, our images are too, quote-unquote, European and familiar and close at hand, and so not worth the effort. So I think that papers at the symposium both really challenge that notion, but also show how rich the field is and how it does embrace changes and how it's changing itself.
So I'm not trained as an art historian, although, you know, the more I've been working on these topics, the more interested I've become in manuscript illumination and using visual sources. But my, you know, original training as a graduate student was in what were then considered to be two separate and often non-overlapping fields, which is medieval studies and Jewish studies. And the idea that one could do both of those things meant that you had to keep a foot in two different camps at all times. And I think that's still the case to some extent, but I think this conference and others give hope that there's gradually, you know, to talk about hybridity or spectrums or whatever, right? There's gradually a sense that to some extent, Jewish studies is medieval studies, and medieval studies is Jewish studies for some of these topics and contexts and regions and time periods. And I think that's a very, very promising direction to be going in. If we look at the history of the field of medieval studies, so I teach pretty regularly at Northwestern, our medieval European field seminar to medievalists, you know, who are coming from all kinds of different backgrounds and who are interested in all kinds of different sources. Looking back at the way the field was constructed, highly Eurocentric, highly Christocentric, the idea that Jews are present in medieval society but aren't sort of medieval society. You know, you find this surprisingly recently, either implicitly or explicitly, being expressed. And so to take specialists in medieval studies and people who study Jewish texts and to say, actually, you guys are working to some extent on the same thing. These are not separate disciplines. Some of us may have some skill sets, some of us may have others. But that's the case for medieval studies in general, right? Nobody can read every medieval language. Nobody can study every medieval archive. But we can sort of see all of these things falling under a single umbrella where the kinds of questions that animate us can be answered in different ways using different sources, but within a sort of shared historiographic rubric. So to me, that's very, very promising. And I'll also just say that this is something that I think is still being debated, let's say, within the field, is when one studies medieval, let's say, religious minorities or other kinds of minoritized populations in medieval society, is our point of entry the way that those groups were seen by the dominant majority culture? And or do we look at the sources produced by those groups themselves to reconstruct sort of, you know, their own self-understanding, to give them their own sense of historical agency, that they're not just the subject of kind of repressive external discourses, but actually have something to say for themselves and are worthy of study on their own terms. And again, the fact that in a symposium like this one, there certainly was no shortage of references to Christian depictions of Jews, visual, textual tropes about Jews in medieval Christian society, but that's constantly being answered back by, okay, but now let's look at the Jewish sources, the visual depictions that Jews made or commissioned of themselves, right? The text that they were writing about, their own understanding of their own bestialization. So that kind of reciprocal dynamic, that I think really is something that is relatively new and very exciting, and that I think bodes very well for the field, not just the field of Jewish studies, but the field of medieval studies qua medieval studies.
From the perspective of art history, we have to be a bit forgiving and tolerant of those who studied art history, Jewish art history, because we don't have a ton of stuff. We don't have a lot. And what we have has not been known for very long. Art history itself is a rather adolescent discipline. Since I started doing it around the time, I would say, the work of Mark Michael Epstein in the 90s, I think we were then at some point reaching a kind of a critical intellectual mass where we could start asking some really interesting questions instead of just simply saying, well, how many Haggadot do we have and how many Bibles do we have and where were they made and who was living where and do we have any documents and what about Dura Europis and what about the Second Commandment, which were, you know, discussed ad nauseum. But I think we're now at the point where we're far more sophisticated. There aren't that many of us who practice Jewish art history, medieval art. But those that do, I think, are starting to ask some pretty significant questions and work on the material in a much more sophisticated manner. So I'm pretty optimistic for the future. That doesn't mean that I'm going to love everything that gets written, and nobody ever does. But I think we're heading in the right direction. And doing this kind of thematic, multidisciplinary conference really just it just adds to the momentum.
I do want to second what David said. I think both, again, as someone who started working on this material fairly recently, the idea of reciprocity, to avoid the binary of the Jewish communities existed in their own silos and so nothing outside it, oscillating between that and, oh, everything that they have done is in response to or influenced by their neighbors. it's a problematic approach, and that approach has been leaving the field, and something new, something that looks, I like David's phrase of minoritized communities rather than minority communities. So I will self-correct. This relationship between the minoritized communities and the world in which they exist and the world that they enrich, I think these are the further avenues for research and also for pedagogy. And in recent years, I started really looking at the field to see where Jewish material is, and it's almost nowhere. So bringing that in has caused me to restructure everything that I teach. I just taught a course on Gothic art, which in the past maybe had one appearance of tripartite Machzor, maybe of that one image of Moses getting the tablets of the law. And now one third of it was on Jewish material.
Before we dive into a discussion of individual papers and some of the, you know, larger insights that we all glean from this conference, I wanted to ask if each of you could give a little bit of context on either the sources, the material culture, what have you, that we are really discussing today, that was the topic of the conference. Maybe, Julie, you want to talk about the Iberian context, and then David and Alina, you can talk about Ashkenaz.
So for manuscript art in Iberia, we have nothing from the great golden age of Al-Andalus, despite the fact that Jews were so much a part of this culture. We don't have anything until the phenomenon commonly known as the Reconquest occurs. So we start to have illuminated manuscripts, I would say probably 1280s or so. There's a Hebrew Bible that's a little earlier that has decorations. So not until the mid-13th century, when Jews are living in a dominant Christian culture. So we have Passover service books called Haggadot, and we have Hebrew Bibles, which are quite significant. And we have, of course, synagogue architecture.
Alina, David, do you want to also address the Ashkenazic context?
Well, I think we have a fair amount of material in the north. In general, we, in addition to manuscripts, and there is an efflorescence, at least in illuminated manuscripts, in what we would consider to be the later Middle Ages, right? We have these wonderful Bibles produced and liturgical manuscripts and festival books. We certainly have a lot of metal work. We have sort of wonderful, you know, Pesamim containers, and we have the Torah finials and all manner of ritual objects. I think that the material in the north is actually extraordinarily rich. It also is by and large in ruins, and we all know why it is in ruins. It was destroyed not just for the accidents of history, but it was knowingly and persistently destroyed in persecutions, and then the enforced exiles and movements. We would have had a whole lot more if not for book burnings that seem to have persisted throughout the centuries. On that happy note, David?
on that happy note, exactly. Yeah, so I think a different, longer version of this conference would have looked not only at written texts and the visual culture that we tackled, but also some of the things that Julie and Alina mentioned, right? The remains of not only synagogue architecture, but also there are some amazing monumental mikvaot, ritual baths that survive in different parts of Europe. There are tombstones, lots and lots of them. So the famous Jewish cemetery that's really amazingly well preserved in Worms, but others as well, some of them in museums, some of them built into walls. There is hoards, the remains of Jewish treasuries that often were buried in anticipation of massacres or attacks on the Jewish community that were only recently uncovered. So I guess a way of summarizing all this is to say that, you know, we've been talking a lot about animality and Jewish visual culture, but I think another exciting growth area would be to think about this in terms of material culture. So not only the beautiful illuminated manuscripts, but also other manifestations of just the immediate surroundings that Jews lived in within their communities. And one of the really exciting things that's happening now is there's so much archaeological work being done, not only in Cologne, but Cologne is a great example, where they are literally just uncovering amazing wealth of material. Cologne was a town about whose Jewish community relatively little was known until, you know, they put a shovel in the ground, and now they are finding an amazing wealth of material. So that kind of material perspective on medieval Jewish history, I think, also is still really in its infancy.
And I think we have, to add to what David said, now more and more studies and sort of exciting conferences and sessions on the afterlives of these objects, something that is extraordinarily important, and more should be done with it. You know, V&A is putting on a conference in November on its Jewish heritage and objects and stories, and it's going to have a really rich array of papers.
Thank you all so much for laying out some of these contexts. I would just simply add to this that in addition to all of this material culture, we also have a vast textual culture that also points to a really connected network of Jewish communities in the Middle Ages. I think this sets us up well to turn to discuss papers. Certainly all of them were fantastic. You know, I filled half of a notebook at the conference just listening to all of them, but I'm sure that there were one or two that really stood out to you as being particularly noteworthy or exciting. And so I'm just curious to hear what those papers were and what they discussed. And I'll also quickly point to the end of this episode. We are going to be featuring some of those speakers who will be discussing those papers, just so everyone can get a taste of what they missed at the symposium.
I think that papers as a whole were really exciting. Personally, as you know, I love hearing about things that are unknown to me. So I was particularly enthralled, actually, by papers presented by not art historians. I already mentioned Beth and Rafe, but I also do a shout out to David Rodman, whose paper on mules just about blew me away.
There was not a single paper from which I didn't learn a lot, and sometimes learn about things that I previously knew nothing about, and sometimes learn new things about topics that I actually thought I knew quite a bit about, and it turns out there's always more. So I guess just one more that I'll give a specific shout out to, but it's really just, I could give, I think, as glowing a recommendation of any of these. But something that I was really taken by was Diane Wolfthal's paper, which was about illuminated Yiddish manuscripts. And within the scholarship on medieval art history, there's so much attention to medieval illuminated Hebrew manuscripts. And what I vaguely knew, but learned so much more about from her presentation and really from her scholarship in general, is the fact that in Yiddish manuscripts from usually the later Middle Ages, there is also a wealth of illuminations that give us access, you know, still to an elite, I guess, in the sense that anybody who, you know, had the sort of capacity to read and write these documents in Yiddish still represents the sort of exceptional stratum within Jewish society. But we could call it maybe a secondary elite, to use a term that has, you know, circulated a lot in studies of early modern Jewish history, or a vernacular elite, people who are not necessarily rabbis, who are not necessarily communal, you know, decisors or judges, but who are writing these amazing manuscripts with descriptions of how to conduct war using the technologies of the late Middle Ages, or all kinds of other just really fascinating, ostensibly non-religious subjects, but they're being written in Yiddish and accompanied by illustrations that shed this really fascinating new light on the way that other members of Jewish society would be engaging with text, would be engaging with images. And this is something that has gotten comparatively so little attention. And her paper really was just phenomenal and very, very eye-opening for me.
I can only echo what I suppose the one that probably knocked me out the most was Rafe Niess's paper, because they presented something that, you know, I sort of thought I knew something about. Hybridity, Kilayim, and the way it was presented just changed everything. And when I'm confronted with what I call a big brain, I stand in awe. And that was a display of a person who not only knew the material, the language, everything, but had the ability to step back and look at it in a way that was radically different and made a perfect case for their interpretation of this material.
Thank you. We're talking about some of the papers that were real highlights for us all, but were there any larger insights that you just really took away from this conference?
I took so many insights. It's hard to think through really how many I mean, I think in many ways we did this really deep dive into linguistics and into theologies and into histories that were intellectual and visual and material. And through all of these histories and through all of these theologies and through all of these language acrobatics, in a way, it really became clear to me, at least, that animals, and I'm here stealing Margaret's marvelous phrase, that animals have become vectors of wonder, and that they help us query really everything from the world's curiosity, the meaning of existence.
I agree with all of that. And I'll just add, you know, impressionistically, this actually combines maybe the last two questions. But I thought it was, I think it was accidental, but I thought it was actually very appropriate that the last formal paper that we heard was from James Robinson, who's at the University of Chicago. He does immaculate textual scholarship in a way that I think would have been recognized and appreciated by, you know, Jewish studies scholars a century ago as much as today. So sort of really well pedigreed in terms of philology, reading really difficult poetic and philosophical texts. And he gave a paper that was about depictions of humans and animals in what we could call canonical philosophical sources within the Jewish tradition. And so in a way, it was the kind of very, very rich and rigorous scholarship that seems timeless in a way, but that when it's put into context with all of the other stuff that we heard and that we learned about, you realize there's an expression in rabbinic literature, hafoch ba ve'hafoch ba dekulei ba. Keep studying the same thing over and over again, because everything is within it, right? Or another rabbinic version of this is shivim panim la-Torah, that the Torah has 70 different facets, and you think you've studied one of them and you've gotten it, but really there's 69 more to go, using Torah metaphorically as a reference to medieval scholarship having to do with Jews. You know, you get the sense that some of the stuff that I think we all have assumed is like long settled scholarship, right? Like the canonical guys, Maimonides and Jewish philosophers and poets. It turns out there's so much more to be extracted or to be studied within that material once it is put into this larger frame. So that was one of the things really that was exciting for me. Not just all the new stuff, but all of the sort of classical stuff that it turns out probably has a whole other set of questions to be asked of it.
Looking outward from the symposium and trying to connect to our broader contemporary context and culture, I would like to ask if there are any ideas we can take from medieval Jewish art, culture, and literature to think through and analyze modern problems and concerns regarding animals, as well as perhaps our current environmental crisis.
I think that one of the main concerns of the symposium, which is this continuum between animality and humanity, is very much a contemporary concern. This shifting understanding about what is particular or exclusive to the human sphere. I think questions of animality and of monstrosity would offer us building blocks for discussing not only medieval, but also modern bioethics, right? Discussions on reproductive practices, for example. But, you know, here we saw images, we saw discussions where non-human animals are allegorized as extra bodily manifestations of human souls, or we heard the discussion of souls transmigrated into an animal. It is very clear that these concerns, from a little bit silly to extraordinarily serious, they all fall on that continuum. And again, this is a concern that is strikingly contemporary, I think.
Those contemporary stakes tend not to get invoked in maybe in our fields of study as regularly as they are in, let's say, environmental history, in eco-criticism, certainly in environmental ethics, right? Among scholars, philosophers, and religious studies scholars who take a kind of a normative approach to these kinds of questions, those present-day stakes of studying the historical material are often put front and center. It didn't happen so much in this conference, and I think that's appropriate, but I do think that you're really right to raise this question as something that is worthy of more investigation. You know, going back already 60, 70 years, some of the formative scholarship on environmental ethics really uses medieval Jewish and Christian theology as kind of a foil for what needs to be done if we are to avoid cataclysmic climate change and environmental destruction. Lynn White is the classic example of this, who wrote this very, very influential paper, basically blaming Jewish and Christian theology for a human-centered, exploitative approach to the natural world. So we've come a long way since then among scholars who study this from an environmental or from an ethical perspective. But often for those scholars, the question becomes, at what point do we study pre-modern material because we think it actually offers us a unique vantage point for understanding these questions? Or are we just kind of trying to read our own environmental commitments back into earlier sources, right? So that question of, are we reading into these sources, or do these sources actually offer us maybe a fresh way of thinking about seemingly modern issues? I think it's still very much up for debate, and it's an unsettled question. And I think only by making a lot of this material available, the visual, the textual, all the different ways in which these questions played out in the conference, it really is, it's just sort of more grist for the mill, where people who want to take this material and think about its contemporary relevance now can at least do so on the basis, not just of a handful of sort of randomly chosen, you know, a grab bag of precedents, mm-hmm. but actually based on much deeper knowledge and understanding about how these issues have played out historically in very, very different kinds of settings.
And I mean, this is so important for the field of art history in general, right? How do we parse, and we've been doing this for years, the relationship between the medieval and the modern? Do we? Is it anachronistic? Can it be done responsibly? And I think we've seen a whole lot of studies outside of medieval Jewish art, certainly, on a facile approach to this topic and a really careful and considered approach to it. So I think this question all of those questions fit really neatly, actually, into where the fields, where the discipline at large is right now.
What's occurring to me is that, you know, it's a long tradition of looking back to religious texts of one sort or the other to prove your point on how we should treat one another, how we should treat the earth, how we should treat animals. Do we have dominion over them? Are we responsible for them? You know, you could argue those points from either direction. I think the more information we have, the better it is. Just the mere fact of raising the issues, for instance, as Rafe Neese did about notions of disability studies or homosexuality and what the normative ideas were. And, you know, we've done this for many years. I mean, about feminism, are we reading certain narratives incorrectly? You know, all of it is endless. If one really must justify one's interest in studying history or the Middle Ages or medieval art, yes, we could do that. I am one of those people who thinks that it has value in and of itself. We don't have to extract some sort of modern application or justification for it. If one exists, that's terrific. But I think we need to accept the fact, or at least believe firmly, that there's value in what we're doing, even if it's hard to make that jump to a modern application.
I couldn't agree more, Julie, in terms of, if one can't justify the importance of studying this on its own terms, then probably you should find a different line of work. That said, so, you know, I brought up Lynn White a moment ago, not disparagingly, but I happen to think that he gets it wrong about the sort of quote-unquote Judeo-Christian roots of environmental exploitation. It's a much, much more complicated story. But one thing that he says that he ends his essay with, and this has been picked up by a lot of scholars of environmental ethics and environmental studies, is that basically, if religion got us into this problem, then we need religion to get us out of this problem. And I'm not sure I agree with the first part, right, that religion got us into the problem. But I do think that there is a lot to be said and thought about the potential of religion. And I don't only mean religious sort of confessional identity, but also study mm-hmm. of the religious tradition.
Yes.
To potentially have these kinds of implications for how we think about, but also how we signal or convey to the wider world why these issues matter. Somebody who doesn't necessarily care, I don't know, about the rate of, you know, how many degrees Celsius the seas are warming over X period of time, right? Whatever. But if there's a way that a kind of a religious idiom or a connection to historical big picture questions is able to actually get people's attention or get people to think about some of these pressing issues and their relevance and their resonance. It's not a reason one should study this, but it might be a very, very nice side benefit, right, of having some of this historical knowledge and to be able to really convey one's enthusiasm for this material beyond the ivory tower, beyond our colleagues and our students, but also potentially to intervene in a way that can actually move the needle more broadly on the way we think about some of these issues. That's the hope, at least.
I think justification is different from insight. We do not need to justify what we do, and we do not need to justify our fields. But if what we do provides insights into modern day concerns, all the better.
Absolutely.
Thank you all for discussing this. I think that it really does point to how a study of the Middle Ages, while fascinating in and of itself, does, as you just said, offer us insights into some of the issues that we are facing in our own time period, and does speak to its relevance, certainly, to a wider audience. And that is, in some ways, the purpose of this podcast, is to try and reach a wider audience with these questions, with this material. And on the topic of making things available, I'm wondering if you three might have any resources or recommendations for anyone who might be interested in learning about these topics. I will share in the show notes the link to the program so that everyone can see who all contributed papers and then go explore those scholars' research.
Well, I'm happy to give a shameless plug of my own book, which I know comes across as pretentious and obnoxious.
No, I hoped you would.
Dave, I was about to mention your book, and you're doing it for yourself.
Yeah, that's, right. I should have waited a second, and then I could have come across as humble. I know that Alina and Julie both have work on this topic, some that they've published, some that's coming out soon, and, you know, we should all be very excited about that. And really, each of the speakers, you know, we didn't choose people in a vacuum. Like, these were scholars who, each in their own way, have published extensively, some of them, on these topics. I hope, in addition to people perusing the program, do a quick Google search for each of those speakers and pick up their books, because there's a wealth of stuff already out there.
When we were putting together the symposium, David is right that everybody we invited has written some extraordinary things. I don't think they are necessarily accessible, but that doesn't matter. I think they all provide excellent starting point. You dive in and it is very difficult. It is so hard, and you still do it. You know, David also mentioned his book. I love that book. That book opened my eyes to all sorts of things. Both Mark and I have books under contract with Penn State Press that, you know, should be coming out, I hope, next year on animalities and zoocephalism. Rafe Neis just published with University of California Press, and it's open access, as far as I know, and it's an extraordinary book. So I think the field is hopping forward.
There's a lot to dive into currently, and I'm very lucky to be a PhD student at this time. Well, with so much at my fingertips.
I'm lucky to have you as a PhD student, I have to say.
Okay. I think that with this in mind and talking very optimistically about all of these exciting things that hopefully listeners will go and give a read to, we'll then end here. But I do want to ask if you have any final comments or thoughts.
Well, I think for me, it's just an exhortation to just go for it, for the future students of medieval Jewish culture in all of its manifestations. Go read, and read a lot, and don't be afraid to ask questions. Go to conferences, organize conferences, just for John.
I'll just add one last closing thought, which is that, you know, we've each said it in different ways before, but having opportunities to work together, that sense of community that can often be hard to come by in what is often an isolating field of solitary work in the library, these opportunities are really something to be treasured. So thank you so much, Reed, for gathering us.
Hear, hear.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much for your work putting together this symposium, for your willingness to debrief over a podcast platform and to share that debrief with our listeners. So I really appreciate it. It's now that we will transition to the second and final part of this podcast, which is very brief segments provided by a few of the presenters of the conference. They'll give some informal remarks on their presentations.
Hi, I'm Sarah Offenberg from the head of the Department of the Arts at Ben Gurion University in Be'er Sheva, Israel. I've been working on a particular manuscript that was produced in 1304 in Germany, and it is unique by combining both text and image together in a sort of an art form that is called micrography, which is minute, very small writing in Hebrew, of the Masora text, the text that helps read the Bible. This Bible looks very much like other Ashkenazi Bibles, other Bibles produced in Germany. But as I started working on this during COVID, and the image of warriors, that's what interests me most, because my other passion is warriors, especially Jewish knights. And I just started working on them from the book of Jeremiah, and then I decided to work on the entire Bible and just looked, browsed through it and found these animals, and I found them interesting, and I'm still trying to understand what is the exact meaning they had for the patron, as far as I can tell. And I was especially interested by a couple of animals, which are double image of each other, which looks like a donkey climbing a ladder, but it has the claws of a lion and feet of a human. And it is from the beginning of the book of Isaiah. In this manuscript, we find multiple animals, some of them regular, and some of them hybrids, or even humans. But here I was most interested in the relation between the text and the image. And the donkeys are related to the donkeys that are referred to in the first chapter of Isaiah. And just before this image starts, we have the end of the book of Ezekiel, where the tribe of Issachar is mentioned, and Issachar's symbol is the donkey. So they are relating between these two pieces together. The Bible was produced by Schneur for Rabbi Jacob, but other than that, we don't know much about it. We know that the manuscript was sold 100 years later in Zurich. And actually, the style is very similar to the style that we find around Lake Constance, around Zurich, during the time that this manuscript was produced. So perhaps it was made there and remained in the family, or something like that, until it was sold. But other than that, we don't have much. What excites me about the manuscript is the combination between the text and the image, because the image is produced out of text. That's what excites me about it. We see the tiny letters that make up the image. You can't separate one from the other. And we can't help but reading it. It's in Hebrew, of course. We can follow it even with our finger. That's the way I'm doing it, so I can keep track on the verses, on the Bible, biblical verses. And we can contemplate on the meaning of the image while reading the text. And it's not exactly the direction that we expect sometimes. It's not easy to follow, because when we have a floral image, we think it might continue in a more logical way, but it continues according to the message that the Masorator, the person who copied and designed the image, wanted us to look. For example, it starts with a floral image and then goes up on the head of the donkey to make an emphasis on the meaning of the donkey. So we see a very clear understanding where the text should be in accordance to the image. My aim is to go through the entire manuscript and understand all the pages that have micrography. So I'm just keep on reading the images and the text with it and try to get to a larger conclusion. So far, according to what I studied, and it's only a few images, it's a very gloom message. It is made as a warning for the reader to contemplate and to be a good Jew, because otherwise the bad things will happen, pogroms, etc. And it was made only 6 years after the largest pogrom of the time, the Rindfleisch massacres. So it is connected to the historical events of the time. Thank you.
I'm Beth Berkowitz. I'm a professor of religious studies and Jewish studies at Barnard College in New York City. And my work in the past number of years has been in the area of animal studies. And my specialization is rabbinic literature. We call it classical rabbinic literature, usually from the period of late antiquity. Kind of an easy way to think about the time period is like 0 to 600. So I've been looking at how rabbinic literature from that period thinks about animals, talks about animals, what kinds of ideas they have about other species. I'm really interested in reception history. So that either takes the form of how various readers of the Bible have understood its language, and then also how rabbinic literature has been received by later readers, including us today. And so looking really closely at the words, their ambiguities, the really rich texture of the Bible, as well as the late ancient rabbinic texts, there are a lot of legitimate ways to read, like a lot of things in the text that can be drawn out. And I'm paying really close attention to the words, which is exactly what the ancient and medieval rabbis did. They're such great readers. And so I think we owe it to them to be great readers too. I've been working on a book project on the theme of kinship among animals. And my focus has been on four laws in the Pentateuch that have as their theme mostly parent-child relationships among animals, among other species. So for my paper for the conference, I looked at a couple verses in Genesis, and I think Genesis really provides the genetic code for a lot of Jewish thinking about animals, the creation story, the story of the flood. And there are a couple verses in Genesis that have always really struck me in terms of the kinship language they use for animals. One of them has to do with the moment in the flood story when Noah is being instructed to take, in this section, seven pairs of animals. And the language used there is the Hebrew is ish v'ishto. And it's the same language used for like a man and his wife, or a couple and kind of spiritual partnership. And I always thought it was really striking that that language is used for animals. And there's another verse later in the story when Noah is taking the animals off the ark that refers to them as mishpachot, which is usually the standard word for family, like in, you know, sort of Yiddish, is people will refer, Jews will refer to their family as mishpacha. So I always thought it was interesting there that that language was being used for animals. So I decided in this talk to look at some of the medieval Jewish exegesis on those terms to see what they did with them and if they kind of really went into that kinship language and saw significance in it or dismissed the significance of that language. I surveyed a number of different medieval Jewish commentaries and found some interesting things there. I do some reading in the science, and one of the really great writers who died recently, sadly, is Franz de Waal, a primatologist who writes all these great books for a broad reading audience. And I used his idea of anthropodenial. It's what he calls it when we kind of push back against our similarities to other species or continuities between who we are and the lives of other animals out there. And he tries to get us to see the ways that we're part of the animal world and have similarities, even while we respect all the differences. So I think when it comes to kinship, I think tapping into the kinds of deep relationships that animals have with each other that are similar, not the same, of course, but similar to the kinds of deep bonds we have within our own kinship relations, I think is a really important way into the animal world and to rethinking our relationships with them. And I think people really love like videos of like mama animals taking care of their babies. Like, it's beautiful. I think people just respond to it. And so I think there's a lot we can get out of thinking more about those relationships. When I approached the sources, I really had no idea what I was going to find when they look at biblical verses that talk about families with respect to animals or a pair bond with respect to animals. Like, do they dismiss it? Do they run with it? I wasn't sure. And what I found was that I'd say the majority of the exegetes that I was looking at do actually dismiss the similarities between humans and other animals. And they take that biblical language and say, well, it doesn't really mean family. It doesn't really mean a real pair bond. It's different. Humans do X, other animals do Y. So, you know, that's something I think we're used to, that kind of dualism or human exceptionalism. So it's sort of par for the course, especially more philosophically influenced exegetes, where that kind of dualism is really like bedrock in terms of the approach to animals. But then it was exciting to find the handful of commentators who were willing to entertain some kind of kinship possibility and continuity of the way animals relate to each other with the way humans relate to each other. I found a few really exciting exegetical patterns where the exegetes were like, no, these were animal families coming off the ark, or this was a real pair bond. And in the Talmud, they even say, like, can animals have marriage? Like, can they get married? They really go with it. And Rashi, the major Bible and Talmud commentator, says, yeah, they stuck to each other. And he may mean to their own species and not to their own particular partner, but the language could be read as him saying they had partnerships. And we know, I mean, you just have to look at ducks in the park, like, you see them in pairs. We know they do that. So you do see this kind of more minority strain, and that was really fun to find.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 3 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Rita O'Mara, and Logan Quigley, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with new episodes.